I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 21, Somebody Hold Me Back.
Dear Matt, I have a new camera. I'm not a very good photographer, but I like taking pictures. And I was looking for something to help me level up my game. So I got an Instax Mini Evo. Now, it should be said, I already own some instant cameras. I own several vintage Polaroids, including an SX70, which is a very good camera, and an SLR 680, which is a very, very good camera. But I almost never shoot with them, for the following reasons. They're big, relatively. Too big and heavy to carry around without in effect announcing your presence as a photographer, an announcement I'm personally not comfortable with. And Polaroid film is expensive, too expensive to shoot promiscuously with, and in its modern incarnation, not very good, too finicky, with iffy color fidelity. The Evo neatly solves both those problems. It's small and cute, and it produces those little Instax prints which are likewise small and cute. You can pocket the prints and the camera without any trouble at all and get on with your day. The Instax film is technically very good, and the Evo solves the problem of auto-printing every exposure, even the bad ones, which in my case are many, by allowing you to preview your shot in camera before making the decision to print. Side note, in this respect, it's not strictly an instant camera at all. It's a digital camera with a printer inside. That distinction goes out to all my photo nerds out there. Anyway, that's the Evo. And here's the thing about it. It isn't a great camera. It'd be hard to argue that it isn't, essentially, a toy. So why was it the camera I got so I could take photographs with the kind of unself-consciousness that lets a person shoot and shoot and shoot until he gets better? I got the Evo because it isn't a great camera. It's limited in what it can do and in how well it can do it. So, let's talk this week about limitations in creativity. When they hurt, when they help, and when to bust right through them. At the risk of stating the obvious, limits can be, well, limiting. And not in a good way. That's the way most people tend to think about them. Creators need tools, and the kind of practical limitations introduced by a tool that isn't well designed or produced can be a hindrance. It's axiomatic that a poor carpenter blames his tools, but it's equally true that it's harder to do a good job with lousy tools than it is with good ones. Example. You have custom juggling balls that were produced to your exact specifications. They're surely better than off-the-shelf juggling balls because they allow you to execute your craft on stage with more efficiency, and that translates into more style and panache. And I'd imagine they give you a little top-off on your confidence. One less prop to worry about, right? Add all this up, and it makes you a better showman. But what about tools that are produced well enough, that function well enough, but are deliberately limited in what they can do? This is where it gets interesting. A tool which does a subset of things other tools can do, or through no fault of its own produces work that's of a lesser grade, this is a tool that makes you work with and work through its shortcomings. Take the Evo. It has the equivalent of training wheels on it. A defined set of choices that simulate different shooting modes, effects, and film stocks. These are things a real photographer figures out how to employ manually, with practice and experience, and can do them quickly, instinctively. And the results that real photographer gets will far outstrip anything you can get on the Evo. But the little bit of friction they cause on the Evo, their functional awkwardness, makes a hobbyist photographer like me stop and slow down and consider each possible combination of effects in turn. Every choice gets more meaningful because you have to put some deliberation behind it. Now, you can see this in every kind of creative work. We've talked before about the ways limitations get imposed in writing. The most common and obvious of these is length, word count. Every novice journalist learns to write to word count and to make choices about what's put in and what to leave out. There's a kind of distillation that takes place when a writer has to boil his subject down. The material becomes richer and more potent the less space you have, not the more. Deadlines are another source of limitation, and as an old Newsweekly writer, I can tell you there's nothing like an upcoming publication deadline to focus your attention. Without it, time gets woozy and elastic. The mind has time to waste, and in my experience at least, will waste it. If you want a piece of writing from me, and you may well have discovered this in our time working together, give me the malevolent, crystalline glint of an oncoming deadline. So, for starters, I'm wondering what your experience of limits has been in the practice of your craft. What sort of barriers get thrown up in front of a performer? And did you go around them or through them? Or just throw up your hands and surrender? I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, okay, sure, let's talk about limits. Like perhaps, for example, the limits involved in me writing this section in response to your purchase of an Instax Mini Evo without mentioning that I had one first. I'm fine, it's fine, no, it's genuinely fine. As Letterman used to say, I kid because I love. It is a lovely little camera, like you say, not strictly an instant camera, technically a digital analog hybrid. But it's a digital camera from many years ago in terms of megapixels and other metrics of the camera arms race. It's pretty rubbish in low light, and if you study the images closely, they often look like they were made on something available in exchange for 10 coupons cut from the back of a cereal box. But the technical advancement of one's tools has never had a direct correlation with the quality of one's art. Like you say, what something can't do forces you to be more mindful and more creative and more aware of the things it can do. And besides, like people say, the best camera in the world is the one you have with you when you see something that you want to take a picture of. The camera that I use for my YouTube videos and my street photography is not unpricey. But even then, for all of my work, I only ever use prime lenses. That is to say, lenses that don't zoom. The only way to change the composure of what you're seeing through the viewfinder is to physically move your position in the real world. I love how the pursuit of an aesthetic choice forces me to explore more of the actual world. If I want the shot to look the way it looks in my head, I might have to be brave, put myself in the middle of the thing I'm shooting. And again, that means I really have to think about what the shot is and where I'll need to be to get it. Limits, in that example, are making me be conscious and thoughtful about my artistic outcomes, or at least about the possible artistic outcomes. It's shifting some of the thoughts that go into the creation of the art from the subconscious to the conscious. Limits make you have conversations with yourself about how to work with them or circumvent them to make the kind of thing you want to make. In my day job, which is of course actually a nighttime job, but you get my point, I quite often get warned when someone is booking me for a show that the venue has a low ceiling. They worry, understandably, that a juggler might have issues. I always tell them that it's fine, and it is fine. For two reasons. Number one reason is that I've worked enough basement comedy clubs in my time to have an act that doesn't need a lot of overhead clearance. I can work basically anywhere, which, more than how good I am, is a good way to get booked. The second reason, though, is more fun. I secretly absolutely adore working a venue with a low ceiling. I walk on stage, introduce myself, tell the audience what I do, glance upward at the roof inches above my head and get my first laugh. My friend, the great clown Pete Mielniczek, used to tell me, a problem to a clown is a gift. And that's something I always have sitting in the back of my head. Parts of my act are being cool and slick and witty, but there's also a significant amount of finding problems for myself. I love to show the audience my struggle. the limits of a low ceiling or a spotlight that I claim is dazzling me, or give me opportunities to frame what I do in a more interesting human way. And yes, I do in fact have my own custom-made juggling balls, and they're lovely. But also, I've had to, on a couple of occasions, when I had to do an extra spot because someone didn't make it to the gig, use a bag of oranges. I can't do quite as many tricks with the oranges, but the audience sees that I just bought a bag of oranges, so the tricks that I do land mean more. So it feels like we're already circling the idea that limitations are often a very good thing for the creative process, a way of distilling, forcing considered thought. But I wonder if that's always the case. I mean, sure, there's an extreme point at which limits become stifling rather than focusing. Having a camera with a fixed focal length and a dependence on finding the right light is one thing, but having the lens cap permanently glued onto the lens would be another. Although having said that, you could punch a hole in the lens cap and make a pinhole camera, so maybe I'm wrong. So, are all limits good, or at least useful? Or am I just trying to justify the purchase of that Instax camera? I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt. Okay. Yes, you have shamed me into an admission. And not for the first time. Here it is. You did have the Evo camera first. Here we have an example of what Jennifer refers to as copying off somebody else's paper. I got the exact camera you got, and to be clear, yes, after you got it, in the vain hope that some of the magic pixie dust that makes you a good photographer would rub off on me. I stipulate that I was copying off your paper. Can we move on now? At this point, you might be asking, so did it work? Is it helping me top up my skills? The answer is, maybe? I mean, look, I wasn't expecting to be Cartier-Bresson after 2 weeks, but I do have some thoughts. The first is, art isn't a one-size-fits-all proposition. The limitations of a tool, in this case a camera, but let's say this is generally the case, affect makers in different ways depending on where they are in the acquisition of their skills. For you, the Evo is a way of usefully dumbing down your practice. I don't mean this pejoratively, even if I am a little stung by the way you called me out for copying off your paper. No, what I'm suggesting is, it's a way of introducing some grit, some friction, into a process you have already significantly mastered. It's a way to force you to slow down to that deliberative pace you talked about, because speed is a byproduct of technical mastery, and sometimes in creativity, speed kills, or at least it wounds. It makes it easier to get high on your own supply, making choices because you can, because your mastery makes them available to you, whether or not they're the best or even the right choices. A reasonably proficient guitar player can play a lot of notes really fast, but sometimes a good solo is the one that hides between the notes, in the pauses, and the silences. For me, for people who are at an earlier stage of acquiring skills, an eye, a voice, the limitations imposed by a flawed or a rudimentary tool allow for something else. They give you a way of approximating mastery. Let me explain what I mean by this. Here comes yet another shameful admission. Are you ready? This is it. I play the ukulele. Yes, I am exactly that pork pie-wearing, goatee-sporting, middle-aged white guy hipster wannabe, and even if I don't actually wear a pork pie, I'm just not a hat guy, I do in fact have a literal goatee. Now, when I say I play the ukulele, what I mean is that I bash away on it for fun. I'm not very good. I'm just good enough to be able to stumble my way through some basic repertoire. A ritual I have with Jennifer is that I play the Andrews Sisters' Christmas Island for her every Christmas morning as we open our presents. I love my wife, and she doesn't ask me for much, so I do this, and it's the only time I ever play for anybody else. By the way, there's been one historical exception to this rule, and we'll talk about that in an upcoming episode. The point is, it's a thing I do for me. Why ukulele, you may ask? Well, several reasons. I like the sound of it. Listen to Lyle Ritz if you get a chance, or to Joe Brown's rendition of I'll See You in My Dreams from the Concert for George if you ever want to hear a master at work. I like the look of ukuleles as design objects. I spent a pleasurable few months early on falling down the rabbit hole of ukulele history, and when I came into a little money from an inheritance, I bought myself my bucket list ute, a 1920s Martin Model 3K, which I play just as badly as the others I own. Above all else, though, the answer to the question, why ukulele, lies in something my friend Jeff Kiseloff, a much more skillful ukulelist than I'll ever be, told me in the early days of my playing. The uke is a worthwhile instrument to take up, he told me, because, in its relative simplicity compared to other stringed instruments, it's a much easier instrument on which to achieve a basic level of competence before your patience runs out. This is a key thing. You can hit cruising speed pretty easily on a ukulele, and then either stay there, as I have, pleasantly plunking away, or devote yourself to study and betterment, as Jeff has. Okay, back to the camera. Which you got first? One of its selling points is that it includes 10 settings that approximate film stocks and 10 onboard lens effects yielding, they're proud of this at Instax, 100 possible looks for any shot. They're stupid easy to apply, and they do a pretty good job. Any professional photographer would look at these options and call the Evo a toy. And he wouldn't be wrong. But for someone like me, they allow a simulacrum of expertise, a chance to vault ahead to something that resembles the results of expertise. They afford a chance to play, and by playing, to get a sense of the results a better tool and a path of study might yield, which is a good way to make an informed decision about whether that path is right for you. You asked if limits are always good, always useful. I don't believe so. A creator who marries mastery of his tools with the ability to know when not to use everything in his toolkit to lay back in the cut is a creator who has the best of both worlds. And for somebody like that, limits are an impediment. But for somebody like me, for a picture-taking, uke-strumming guy like me, limits are my friend. They're a way for me to look around the corner to a place I might get to and decide whether I should. Does that make sense? I'll talk to you next time.
Dear Bill, thank you for your brave admission that I had the camera first. I have instructed my legal team to stand down for now. I guess the theory is that it's a fun, easy little camera to just throw in your bag and always have with you. This isn't such a boon for me in that I almost always have at least two and usually more cameras in my bag because I'm that kind of weirdo. Adding this camera to my loadout has, though, inspired and empowered me to take slightly different kinds of images, since the limits that the Evo imposes push you in a particular aesthetic direction. Also, anything that fills the spaces in my day with artistic activity is good, as the voices in my head get less loud when that's happening. You mention Henri Cartier-Bresson, which gives me permission to relay my favourite of his quotes about photography, which is, "Sharpness is a bourgeois concept." It's interesting hearing you talk about speed versus slowing down. When I take my proper expensive posh camera with the manual focus extremely shallow depth of field lens out to do some street photography, speed is everything. That's one of the things I love about doing that. I see something happening or perhaps about to happen and I have to get into position, twist that focus in sharp. I am, after all, bourgeois, which can be almost impossibly difficult if the subject is moving, then rack the exposure to the right place and do all this without spooking whatever it is I'm trying to capture. It's really hard, but when I nail it, I feel agile and graceful and sly. But with the Evo, the whole thing feels less in motion and more static. No more or less artistic or thoughtful or difficult, but oppositionally different in process. Gentler, maybe. Slower, certainly. I didn't have a very good relationship with my dad, but one of the things he said to me a long time ago was, "The most powerful thing you can do as a performer on stage is almost nothing." And perhaps that's as good a motto as any about the artistic power of slowing down. You play the ukulele. I did not know this, I think. It's a very sweet instrument that has, over recent years, got a bad rap thanks to behatted hipsters submerging it in irony and then letting it poke out of the top of a JanSport backpack. Similar to what happened in the great harmonica blight of the 1980s, when it became the accessory of choice for the middle-aged white dude who wanted to be in a band, and thought that if he kept a harp in the back pocket of his Walmart black jeans, it was surely only a matter of time before that happened. My friend Tricity Vogue is a professional ukuleleist. She uses it to front an all-girls swing band. Yes, just like in Some Like It Hot, except as far as I know, two members of her band are not in fact witness to a mob murder on the run in drag. It is cabaret though, so you never know. Tricity used to host a regular ukulele cabaret show at the Edinburgh Fringe, and I think I was the only regular guest who did not, in fact, play the ukulele. Instead, I would juggle them, talk about them, balance them, basically use them in any other way I could. For my final ever appearance, I bought a cheap ukulele, went on a rant about how much I hate them, then put it on the stage and juggled bowling balls over it before letting them fall and smash it to pieces. The look of shock on Tricity's face and the stunned whimper of the audience will stay with me forever. I am an awful person. Anyway, back to what I'm supposed to be talking about. The thing about limits in creative work is that artists, or at least a certain kind of artist, love saying that they ignore all limitations. It makes them sound like the romantic ideal of an artist. Boundaries are for squares, man. A real artist just skips wherever the muse takes them. This is, of course, silly and untrue. There are always limits. You push past one limit and you're still within others. It's turtles all the way down. The real thinking to be done is about which limits will help you, inspire you, constrain you in an interesting way, and which limits are just not as important. It's worth remembering that we're not all subject to the same limitations. Who we are, where we are, what we are, how we exist in the world, these are the things that determine which walls get put up around us. Elon Musk's dad, for example, says that when Elon was a kid, they had so much money that they, and I'm quoting here, couldn't close the safe. So when you come from that level of privilege, it's much easier to be the kind of idiot who embraces ideas like move fast and break things, and thinks that limits don't apply because of your genius rather than your luck. Personally, I'm more a fan of moving at medium speed and fixing things. So I guess what I'm saying is that there are limitations and limitations. And although it's always good to remember the all caps real world limits that govern people's lives at the most basic level, we're talking about the lowercase artistic restrictions. The kind of limitations that, now that I think about it, are almost entirely self-inflicted. I chose to use a manual focus prime lens. I chose to get an Evo camera. Is there a word for limitation that you force on yourself? I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I don't always have a ready answer to the questions you pose, but I do for this one. In creativity, a limitation you impose on yourself is a choice. It's a way of sorting the terms under which you engage in creative work, embracing some, setting others to the side. The Evo is a choice. At least, it is if you're lucky enough to be able to afford it. There is a kind of limitation that prevents you from buying a new camera because you want to play with it. That limitation is called poverty, which makes voluntary self-limiting, at least in this case, not just a choice, but a privilege. You sort of flick at this when you say there are all sorts of limits, and it's true. Some limits we adopt, some we simply acknowledge because they're there, and pretending otherwise doesn't make that less so. So let's talk for a minute about the kind of artist who says he doesn't see limits, doesn't respect them, just powers right past them. This is, as you say, a pose, which makes these creators, hang on, I'm checking my notes here, posers. I guess there's a kind of self-aggrandizing glamour in the pose, but it's a little silly. And ultimately, it's self-defeating. There's a quote that's widely attributed to Theodore Roosevelt, although T.R. himself sourced it to his friend, Bill Widener. Do what you can, with what you have, where you are. Now, Roosevelt probably used it in the context of something virile, bare-chested, and muscular, but it's equally applicable to headier aspirations like creativity. You work with the tools you have, and if you can figure out a way to take whatever limitations your time, place, and circumstances impose on you and make them work for you, you're ahead of the game. After that, any additional limitations you want to impose on yourself and your process are gravy. They're a way of stretching the frame, manipulating it, adapting it. Creative growth is, in part, a way of gaining familiarity with your own process and then figuring out how to game it. Working with limits, acknowledging the ones you find, adding the ones that are useful, is a part of that. I remember the Great Harmonica Scare. Even before that, of course, there was punk and the DIY scene. I was in college for that one. And all of a sudden, it was fashionable to claim the technique was unnecessary, that anybody could be in a band, man. You could just get up and bash, which a lot of guys, and some women, did. So many that my friend Rob Falk used to mutter that we didn't need gun control in America. If we really wanted to do something to protect the populace, we should enact guitar control. Rob, it's worth noting, was a bass player. I don't think I ever met a bass player who wouldn't have been happy to tie his guitarist up in a sack, fill it with rocks, and drop him in a lake. In fact, I think the only thing bass players and guitarists have ever agreed on is their mutual contempt for ukulele players. All right, Matt, let's wrap this one up. What have we learned about limitations that makes us better, more agile creators? I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, yes, you make a strong point when you say that any self-imposed limit, such as this camera that we keep banging on about, and really, how are we not sponsored by Fuji at this point? Anyway, any self-imposed limit is not a limit, but a choice, and inherently a display of privilege. When you put it that way, it doesn't feel like there's much of a difference between I'm going to shoot this photo in black and white because it feels right, and I'm going to limit myself to black and white shots today because I want blah 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 something something artist. The only difference is intention. And even then, there's the question of how honest that intention is. It feels like the more interesting and meaningful kind of artistic limits are when they're not self-imposed. That's perhaps more of a test of the mettle of an artist. If it's a choice, it's not a real limit. And if it's a real limit, then the choice becomes how to work within the limits or break through them. Real limits, like poverty and opportunity, are limitations for life, not just for art. And when I think about artists who overcame real-world limits, one example springs to mind. In the late 70s, there were people living in extreme poverty in areas of New York that had been literally left to rot by the city. Every aspect of their neighborhood conspired to tell them how little they were worth, how unimportant they were, that their voices were not worth hearing, that they were, in every way, less than. You would assume that the first thing to be snuffed out in the soul of a young person born into this life would be art. But perhaps, if you tell someone how small they are, and if that person is an artist, it might not be long before you see their name, beautifully painted in tangled letters and vivid colours, on the side of a train, lighting up their brown and grey derelict world like a neon sign. Clear, defiant, spectacular proof that they aren't so small after all. To have nothing but an artistic drive and a developed skill, you'll need to steal the paints and sneak out in the middle of the night. You'll need to trespass, work in pitch black until your finger freezes on the spray can nozzle. You'll have to dodge violent cops who already see you as a blight on society even before you leave your house. And when you're running from them, don't step on the third rail or it's all over. You're risking everything, literally everything, to express yourself. Surely, this is the prime example of an artist overcoming limits. But then, if you're lucky, you'll sit out at the right spot the next morning and you'll see it glinting in the early sunlight, full of commuters and with your name on it in whole car size letters. Not the name you were given, the one you chose. The one you wanted to throw into a city like a signature on your neighbourhood. Your friends might not be good with a marker or a spray can, but maybe some of them make music without instruments or just with their mouth. Perhaps they flatten out a cardboard box and make their own dance floor, or they write poetry to be read to the beat of secondhand records. Hip-hop is, to me, one of the great stories of art. That people with so little it might as well be called nothing took their anger, their rebelliousness, and the artistic beauty in their souls and birthed a movement that took over the world. Whole communities had been left to fend for themselves in decaying ghettos, with the expectation that if the land was left fallow for long enough, there would be a time when it would be ripe for gentrification. But instead, astonishingly, a generation of artists, writers, musicians, and dancers rose up and told their stories in a whole new way. So, there's nothing wrong with self-imposed choices, and it's fine to call them limits, too. But it's minor league compared to the originators of hip-hop. Or the sappers of the Congo, who, when faced with poverty, corruption, and colonialization, replied with dandyism and levels of personal style I can only wish to emulate. Or the ballroom scene, where queer and predominantly non-white people, some of the most ostracized and discriminated against groups in America, founded houses, places of support, shelter, healing, and art, and competed in drag balls, where they took peacocking to an Olympic thermonuclear level of nuance, meaning, and, to use one of the many words that scene gave to the world, realness. Do what you can with what you have, indeed. So here's to them. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.